Today is Friday, November 6th, 2020. This is a part two Grand Canyon oral history interview with Carl Bowman, B-O-W-M-A-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Carl. How are you today?
Oh, I'm pretty good.
Good. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
You absolutely do.
Thank you. Last time we ended up, you were finishing your junior year of college, and you had done a hike in Grand Canyon, and on the way back from the hike, had stopped at Petrified Forest National Park to visit, because they'd offered you a job, or they'd offer you an interview, if I get that right, and then they'd offered you a job at the end of the interview.
Correct. For
a summer seasonal position. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And then, so you would have gone back to Las Cruces, finished off your semester, and then loaded up your stuff and headed to Petrified Forest. What happened then?
Well, I after school was out, I had been working at the snack bar in Bandelier the previous two summers, and they asked me to come in for a couple of weeks to help train my replacement. And so I did that. My job at Petrified Forest didn't start until the Memorial Day weekend. So I got in two last weeks at the Bandelier Snack Bar, and the folks, my park friends at Bandelier, were very happy for me that I'd finally gotten on.
With
the Park Service. And when they found out that it was a Petrified Forest, they said, "Well, that you can start there, and maybe you can get someplace nice next summer." Petrified Forest at that time did not have the best reputation as being a place to work, but I was real excited. Headed out there, and my job was working in the entrance station at the Painted Desert Visitor Center. And
what did your duties there involve?
It would be that summer. It was the last summer they did it this way, but that summer we worked in the entrance station pretty much exclusively. And so we would head out there in the little box, and people drive in, and of course we would sell them their entrance permit, which was a buck, or Golden Age or Golden Eagle card. The Golden Eagles were $10 at that time. And the other thing that we did was we would ask them if they had any petrified wood in their car. And we would, if they did, and it was just raw, it hadn't been polished or processed into something else, why, we would either seal it up in a bag or mark it so that it was obvious that they hadn't stolen it from the park.
Ah. Was that often? Did you do that often, or was that kind of rarely? I'm surprised you were even asking people.
Oh, yeah. Every car that came in, and actually the concessioner, which was Fred Harvey at the time, only sold polished wood.
Okay.
Or lacquered or something. And so that was pretty easy, because most people coming in the north end of the park really hadn't had a lot of opportunity to buy petrified wood yet. And their lust for it hadn't been excited by driving through the park.
Okay.
But I'd say about, one out of every 10 cars or so would have some.
Wow.
And we had this giant yellow crayon that we would just put an X on the wood with or whatever. The other kind of amusing thing was, at that time, Arizona was still doing the agricultural inspections over at Sanders when you came into the state on I-40.
Right.
And so people get hit by that, and then 30 miles later, we're asking them if they have any petrified wood. And,
got any oranges? Got any petrified wood? Oh, my gosh.
It would be, we'd say, "Well, do you have any petrified wood or rocks that you're bringing in the park?" And they'd say no, and especially kids would say, "Oh, but we have some oranges." Well, no, we're not worried about that. So we'd get them all set up with the permit and their marked wood, give them a little park map, and send them on their way. And then when folks were coming out of the park, we'd check their permit, and we would also ask them if they'd stolen anything. And which oddly enough, every now and then people would admit to. And then we'd call one of the patrol rangers and they'd talk to them and perhaps search the car if they felt like they had probable cause and that sort of thing. But that was the sort of thing that only happened maybe once a day, I guess. But the petrified wood theft was a very big deal at the time.
Hmm.
And as you drove up to the entrance station, oh, about a quarter mile back, there was a sign that said vehicle inspection ahead. We would watch the cars driving up, and every now and then we'd see the rocks flying out the window. And once a month, we would go out there and collect all the wood and all the petrified wood that had been thrown out of the cars. And,
right.
Every now and then, some baggies full of herbal material and that sort of thing.
My gosh.
We'd weigh it all. And at that point, we would take the petrified wood that we recovered and take it back out to the sites and scatter it.
Okay.
Years later, I suggested and the park agreed that we should quit scattering the stuff because different wood deposits in the park were of different ages, and we were messing up the paleobotany by jumbling things.
Interesting.
And so after that we had a designated spot we took it to.
I'm confused, Carl.
Okay.
How was it that visitors were collecting petrified wood before they entered the park? Was it just that prominent all around the high desert there that they would just say, oh, look at that, let's just stop right here before we even get to the park? Or were they driving through the park before they got to the entrance station?
They would buy it almost always. They would have it from like rock shops or curio shops.
Even the stuff they were throwing out the window.
Oh, the stuff they were throwing out the window. Yeah, that was as they were exiting the park. So it was stuff that they had picked up while they were driving.
I see. Got it. So as they were heading to the exit station, they'd see a sign that said you're going to be inspected, and they would pitch the stuff out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And it was. You know, every now and then we'd get, I remember one fellow who came out and I asked him if he picked up anything and he said no. And I said, so how about that piece that's there on the dashboard?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, oh, I forgot about that. And so he reaches and grabs it and surrenders it to me. And as he's squirming around to get it off the dashboard, I see another piece on the seat and so... He was probably the clumsiest petrified wood thief I ever encountered.
And would you just say, all right, let me have this one, let me have that one, or did you actually call law enforcement?
We would call law enforcement on those things.
Okay.
We would recover, you know, what was obvious, but we weren't commissioned to do the searches or anything like that.
Got it.
And so the law enforcement rangers would come in and handle that.
How did you handle your cash registers at that time?
It was Petrified Forest had a year or two previous, there had been an employee who had started collecting the permits from people in the outbound lane, selling them to the people in the inbound lane, and pocketing the difference. Because instead of issuing him a new permit that would show up on the register tape, he just issued him an old permit, and also selling the $10 Golden Eagle cards, the annual passes, out of the middle of the deck. And so consequently, the two entrance stations to the park printed their permits in different colored ink, and periodically some of the supervisory staff would come out and perform an audit. You know, they'd look at people's permit. They'd say, you know, where did you enter the park, and make sure that the permit was printed in the right color, and how much did you pay for it, and all that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
And then we would also sign in and out of our shifts, where every time we changed shift in the entrance station, the money had to balance the the cash register. So we were doing that several times a day. And if at the end of one of your shifts, if your money didn't bounce up, you had to make the money up out of your pocket. And then at the end of the day, all the cash register receipts and the money would go into a safe. And then periodically, almost daily during the summertime and once a week during the wintertime, we would bundle all the money up, check to make sure everything was perfect, and then mail it off to the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco.
By mail? Huh.
That was a job I actually picked up my third summer there. Was I started doing the remittances to the San Francisco, to the Treasury, and that was amusing. We would actually have these huge envelopes bulging with cash that we would mail by registered mail to the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco. It was the most clumsy, awkward procedure imaginable. And we couldn't mix checks and cash. We had to do separate remittances for both. And one time I did make a mistake, just a typo on a check remittance. So the Federal Reserve Bank was a nickel short, and they demanded their nickel. And it took hours to prepare these remittances. And so I spent hours preparing a remittance for 5 cents to make up the difference to the Federal Reserve Bank. So definitely a very clunky system, but that's how we did it.
Okay. What was your housing like?
We had different kinds of housing. So I guess the way to run through it is seasonals were in shared housing. And my first summer, I shared a one-bedroom apartment in the Painted Desert Visitor Center complex there with another seasonal. My second summer, they made a three-bedroom house into a dorm that I shared with five or six other guys. Then my third summer, I lived in a little CCC cabin that was up on the Painted Desert Rim near the Painted Desert Inn. And I had it, that quote-unquote summer, I actually started in March and worked through until the following year. And sometimes I would have a roommate and sometimes I wouldn't. But that place had a living room and a kitchen and a bathroom and a closet, and they'd walled off a porch so that it was just wide enough for a twin bed. So one of us would sleep on that walled-off porch, and the other one would sleep in the living room.
Wow. So it sounds like a really huge housing shortage.
No, it was there wasn't a shortage, but at the same time, there in the height of the summer, there wasn't any spare either. In those days, the park was much more concerned about the number of employees that they would have, what we call FTEs, full-time equivalents, was a much bigger deal than it was later on in my career. In fact, it was a big enough deal that I know one year I got laid off for the day that they calculated the FTE, and then I was rehired a couple of days later so they could get the FTE down to the level it was supposed to be.
Wow. Okay.
So, which was kind of amusing.
You mentioned that your last 2 weeks there at Bandolier at the snack bar, training someone up, your NPS friends were happy that you had an NPS job, but they were a little concerned that you were going to Petrified Forest because it didn't have such a good reputation. What was the reputation it had, and why were they concerned?
The reputation at that time was just that it was a boring place to work. There was nothing going on, and that was true to a certain extent. We didn't have much in the way of interpretive programs.
Hmm.
Not that I would have done them as a working in the entrance station. So it was when you went to work at the entrance station, that was just about all you did. My first summer there, I did get a couple of breaks. There were on occasion the schedule would work out such that we had more people than we needed,
Okay.
and so I would be sent on a backcountry patrol,
Ah.
which was to go out and hike in the Painted Desert all day. One day, this was before 1974 was before. Just barely, the Park Service really started intensively training law enforcement people.
Okay.
So one day they showed me how to turn on the lights and siren and sent me out on road patrol and said, just drive around. We won't give you any tickets. You don't have a gun, but just drive around, wave the flag. And so I did. I think I did pull over one guy for going 70 in a 45, but
Oops. And then what could you just say? You walk up and just say, hey, you're going a little fast, just slow down.
Yeah,
Okay.
that was basically it. Yeah, that was so my first summer there, it was not a lot of it wasn't a lot of fun. I was enjoying the fact that I finally got to work for the Park Service. The charm of that did kind of wear off by the end of the summer, and I was definitely hoping that I would get a different park the next year. So I finished up the summer and immediately drove back down to Las Cruces. My last day of work, I had classes the next morning, so it was
Oh, wow.
just pretty much, get off work, drive whatever it was, 300 miles and go to class the next day. So then did the first 2 semesters of my 3 semester senior year, and then went back to Petrified Forest again the following summer. I'd applied for a bunch of other different parks, but Petrified Forest had offered me a rehire, and I was kind of unfamiliar with the way the system works, so I said, oh yeah, I'll come back. Nobody else has hired me yet. And so it's kind of like, oh, I found out later on that no, I could have accepted the rehire and then taken a job at a different park
Oh,
and
interesting.
canceled out on them. But I didn't know that, and so I wound up going back to Petrified for my second summer there.
1975. And now you're, let's see, so was that, did you completed your senior year then of college?
No, I actually, I was, there were some other classes that I wanted to take,
Okay.
and there was some question as to whether or not I was 1 credit hour short.
Ooh.
And so I just decided I would do a third semester, the fall semester of 1975, before I finished out my degree. And that gave me a semester to kind of take a few other classes that I had wanted to take, and by that point, in spite of working at Petrified Forest, I still wanted to work for the Park Service. So I kind of rounded out. I took like a wildlife management class and a forestry class and that sort of thing.
Nice.
That last semester, and finished my degree up in December.
Okay.
And the other thing that kind of relates is that fall, the Park Service had made a wilderness recommendation for Bandelier National Monument. And so I read through it and thought, well, this is nice. I'd make a few changes. And so I, sent back comments, and the Park sent me a very nice little letter that said, thank you for your comments. We know you know the place, but unfortunately the comment period is closed, so we can't do anything about them. Your only other avenue is to write your congressional representatives. And so I did. And I sent both New Mexico senators and my congressman copies of this thing. Well, it turned out that I think Pete Domenici was in his freshman year in the Senate, but he had been thinking about establishing his environmental chops. And here comes my letter, and they said, oh, well, this is something he could introduce to show that he's environmentally aware. And so he writes me back and says, you know, this is great. We would love to adopt your changes to the Park Service proposal and introduce them as a bill. And so I worked with his office and with a group called the New Mexico Wilderness Coalition, I think it was.
Yep.
Came up with a final proposal, and then Domenici submitted it in the Senate. And I was doing double duty. I also used that as kind of a senior thesis in my my last semester in college.
Huh.
Then I was out of school and didn't have a job. Petrified Forest was going to hire me, but they couldn't hire me yet. They didn't need me, and there was some other stuff going on. And so I was a substitute teacher for a few months in Los Alamos, and wound up going and testifying before the subcommittee in the Senate about my bill. So I gave them a little slideshow.
This is in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah, it was definitely, I caught a red eye in, did my testimony, and then took a red eye back.
Wow.
And so that was kind of fun. And the bill actually did pass, not independently. I think it was part of a package, and then it got changed some more in conference committee and that sort of thing. But
very neat.
It was a little bit sticky because I did go back to Petrified Forest in like March, and it was kind of like, well, I should let you know that I'm working on this wilderness bill for Bandelier National Monument, and I'm not supporting the Park Service bill. And the superintendent says, oh, that's not a problem. It's a different park. And
who was the superintendent?
At that point, it was a guy named Dave Ames.
How do you spell Dave's last name?
A-M-E-S.
And what was he like? What do you remember about him?
Oh, he was a young guy. I don't know that it was his first superintendency, but he was a real good guy to work for. He was very interested in what was going on in the park, and he had been there, I believe. Well, I'm trying to remember. He wasn't there my first summer, summer of 74. I think he may have come in the summer of 75. I should probably back up a little bit to talk about 1975.
Yes, please.
In the Park Service, since I kind of finished up my college career there. In 1975, they had decided that working the entrance station just straight through was kind of too boring. And so they had combined the interpretive function and the entrance station function. So sometimes you would work the information desk in the visitor center, sometimes you'd be working the entrance station, and then occasionally you'd also be working on site out at different overlooks in the park. And so that added a little variety to the work that really made it a lot more fun. We would periodically, we'd wind up working at the south end of the park, and there was no government transportation. So if you lived at the north end, you would commute to the south end of the park in your own personal vehicle and then work the visitor center down there or the entrance station occasionally, and then drive back north again. Depending on staffing levels, as we went along, we would drop people off at some of the overlooks inside of the park if they were going to be working there. And then you would, if you had one of those shifts, you would be then stuck at Pueblo or whatever, you'd be there for over 8 hours, just kind of on your own with the radio and your lunch and lots of water, talking to people until your ride was done with their shift at the south end of the park and was headed back north again. The other thing that happened that summer was the Painted Desert Inn got its new lease on life. So the Painted Desert Inn is this sits on the rim of the Painted Desert about 5 miles from the park entrance. And it started out its life as a lodge, Cheerio shop, restaurant, cha-cha-cha sort of thing, before that area became part of the park.
Okay.
And run by a private individual. Then when the park was expanded in the 30s, his property was bought out willingly. He'd been, the last name was Lore, L-O-R-E. He'd been actually a proponent of expanding Petrified Forest to include that section of the Painted Desert. And so it was a big CCC project then to completely remodel his Painted Desert Inn into this Pueblo-style building with a curio shop, a restaurant, information station, ranger station, a few rooms, and that sort of thing. Went through a number of concessioners. Eventually, the Fred Harvey Company took it over, and Mary Jane Coulter of Grand Canyon fame oversaw the redecorating of the interior of the inn.
Okay.
Then the inn had some structural problems. It was built on some of the expanding clays that Petrified Forest is well known for, and literally was starting to fall apart. So during Mission 66, the new visitor center was, and housing area and everything else, was built down by Route 66, Interstate 40, and the Painted Desert Inn was abandoned. And in 1974, my first summer there, there was actually a team from the Denver Service Center who came out to the park to examine the inn to decide where they were going to place the charges to blow it up.
Oh, wow.
And get rid of it. Then the next summer, I came out, 1975, and the park staff is busy as bees fixing the place up as a new museum and information center for the park, getting it ready for the celebration of the bicentennial the following year.
What brought about the change?
Well, one of the seasonals that worked there really loved the building, convinced the chief of interpretation, who was a guy named Hoyt Rath, H-O-Y-T-R-A-T-H, and Dave Ames, convinced them that this was a really cool building and it was worth saving. And they agreed with him, and they called off the demolition plans.
Oh, my gosh.
And did some, initially, a lot of the work was just cosmetic, not fixing the structural problems with the building, but plastering over the big cracks in the wall.
Okay.
And we opened up that summer a couple of rooms that we had an information center, and then we showed the park movie in the old snack bar. And it was dreadful. That was the very worst shift. The park movie was shown on just a regular old movie projector. The room that we showed it in had some windows, but no forced air ventilation or anything like that.
Ooh.
So even though we would open it up between showings, it just got stuffier and stuffier over the course of the day. We would have to stay in there to run the movie projector to show the movie. And it was a good thing we did, because by the end of the day, on rare occasions, people would actually pass out. The room was so hot and stuffy. We did, you know, that did save the Painted Desert Inn. The following summer, we had, for the bicentennial, we opened up the old curio shop and had Native, I'm trying to remember. Oh, that was the year we had Ted DeGrazia, an artist from Phoenix, had a display of his artwork in there, in the curio shop portion of it, and then still the information center and the movie, although we did have better ventilation by that time.
Hmm. Interesting.
So in 75, the Painted Desert Inn got added on as another place that we could work.
Okay.
And then I went back, got embroiled in the Bandelier Wilderness, came back to work, I believe it was in March.
You know, Carl, let's spend a little bit with Bandelier. Do you remember what exactly, when you read the wilderness plan, what did you see that was deficient, and what did you think should be changed?
Okay. Well, there are a couple of things. It was let me get my thoughts in order here. A couple of things going on. One of them was that I thought that they had excluded some sections of the monument that I thought were worthy of wilderness protection.
Okay.
The other thing was that Cochiti Dam was being built downstream from the monument, and it was going to flood the Rio Grande Canyon that formed the eastern boundary of the monument. And initially, I later found out that it wouldn't have worked, but initially, I thought that by extending wilderness down to the Rio Grande, that they could keep from flooding monument lands,
right,
with the reservoir. And then also, it was kind of interesting. They had a donut hole in the middle of the wilderness around a couple of significant archaeological sites that they wanted to be non-wilderness to provide for excavation. Well, my initial thought was, well, yeah, but then there's this other big site over here. It should have its own donut hole. So I took their donut hole, pared it way down so that it actually just included the sites and not a bunch of the surrounding territory, and then created a second donut hole for the second site. So the first site was the Yapashi Pueblo and the Shrine of the Stone Lions, and then I added on a donut hole around the San Miguel ruin.
Hmm.
And then later on, the archaeologists got involved, and not part of my proposal, but part of the final compromise or whatever, said, no, we don't, you know, we can excavate these sites in keeping with wilderness procedures and
nice.
That sort of thing. We don't need these donut holes. So both of them went away.
Great.
Yeah, so there are no donut holes in the Bandelier Wilderness. The other thing that I wanted to do was not for the Park Service Wilderness proposal, but as a corollary, was to examine some Santa Fe National Forest lands adjacent to the monument that I also thought were, you know, wilderness potential. And that didn't go through as part of the bill, but some of those lands were eventually designated wilderness as well.
Nice.
So
what happened with the dam? Because was the dam already in place? Had it already impounded water up into the monument?
No, it was under construction, and initially it was going to flood the entire eastern boundary of the monument and for several miles further upstream. But this is something I don't know for sure, but I think they goofed in some of the engineering specs on the dam, and then there wasn't as much water as they thought there was going to be.
Oh.
But in any event, the end result was that the reservoir was never filled as full as they thought it would be. And so although it has backed up past, you know, along the eastern boundary of Bandelier. Usually it just extends a short ways into the monument, but not all the way up the eastern boundary.
Okay. And it's interesting because, in theory, wilderness lands are supposed to be a place where they're primitive and unconfined, and they don't show the hand of man.
Right.
So how was that kind of worked out?
Basically, and as I recall, this is long enough ago, I'm not positive. I think there's a clause in the Wilderness Act about existing impoundments. And the fact that Cochise Dam was already under construction qualified it as an existing impoundment.
Okay.
And so it couldn't be used, you know, creating a wilderness in Bandelier afterwards could not be used to stop the impoundment. And I'm thinking now that eventually the wilderness boundary is the high water line of the lake.
Oh, okay.
Which has never reached, but it is.
Okay.
It was drawn at the high water line. And the park did go through, and they did some salvage archaeology on the reservoir site.
Okay. Good. All right. Thank you for covering that. So 74, 75 at Petrified Forest. Now, help me get this right again, because I blew this last time. Is it Petrified Forest National Park, or is it?
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Right.
It's not.
It was a national monument up until 1958.
Okay.
Congress authorized it to become a national park once all the private inholdings had been acquired.
Mm.
And the private inholdings were acquired, I believe it was in, 1962. And so the designation changed from national monument to national park.
Okay, all right. That makes sense. What else do you remember? What other interesting things happened in your summer season there, 74, 75?
Well, let's see. That would be... '74, then '75 was the Painted Desert Inn. And then my ability to start doing some interim. The other thing that we tried doing, just because Petrified Forest didn't have a really big, vibrant interpretive program, didn't mean that there weren't a bunch of us that wanted it to have one. And so one of the rock shops outside the south entrance of the park allowed people to park in their parking lot overnight. So kind of an informal campground. They didn't have showers or anything like that. They had, I think they had an outhouse for people to use.
Mm-hmm.
But we went ahead and built a big projection screen down there and tried out giving evening programs.
Huh.
At this informal commercial campground outside the south entrance. Not a huge attendance at it, and so that was the only summer that we did that.
Was that the same film that was being shown?
No, this was, we would troop down there with a slide projector and actually give a slideshow about something.
Okay.
And as I recall, sometime one of those two summers, I actually gave an evening program at Sunset Crater as well.
Hmm.
I mentioned that I worked at Petrified Forest in the Visitor Center at Sunset Crater, and they said, "Oh, you should come and give an evening program on Petrified Forest sometime. We'd give you a place to stay in the campground."
Huh.
And I was still trying to get myself through college, and it's kind of like, "Oh, a free place to stay in Flagstaff."
Yeah.
So I did do an evening program at Sunset Crater one time.
Nice.
So, but,
back in 74, 75, when you could actually climb to the top of the crater.
I'm trying to think. It runs in my mind that it had just closed, but
Okay.
I'm not positive. I know you could still go into the ice cave.
Okay.
So I can't remember about the climb to the top of the crater or not.
Well, you would remember running down it, so.
Oh, yeah. I know I never climbed to the top of it.
Okay. All right.
But yeah, one of my neighbors, my first summer 74, was a geology major, and he was the one that kind of sparked my interest in geology. And he talked about, I think he'd been at, well, he must have been at NAU, and talked about they would have to go up and down Sunset Crater to get in shape for their day hike to the bottom of the Grand Canyon field trip for
Gosh.
his geology classes at NAU.
Wow. Huh. Did you travel, did you go up to Page, up to Lake Powell up there? Did you go west over to Lake Mead? Did you go to Grand Canyon as you were there in 74, 75? Were you able to save up enough money to get some gas and tool around and explore some of the country there?
Not very much. I was pretty focused on saving enough money to pay for my college,
Okay.
and so I would make a couple of trips into Flagstaff, and see the parks, Sunset Crater, Wapiti, and then swing down and come home the long way, go down through Oak Creek Canyon, Montezuma Castle, and then at that time the General Crook Trail wasn't paved, but I would take that across to 87, back up to Winslow and back. So
Wow.
that was about the extent of my travels those summers.
Okay.
But
Where did you go shopping? Where'd you get your food?
for the most part in Holbrook. At
Okay.
that time there was one safe there was the Safeway in
All right.
Holbrook, so it was once a week. Drive into Holbrook, get some groceries, head back out.
Okay.
And then my trips into Flagstaff were a combination of sightseeing and shopping.
Okay. Go to the big city in Flagstaff to go shopping. Okay.
Yeah, this was the Kmart over by where Cal Ranch is today. That was the big stop. And then the Fort Valley Shopping Center was a real shopping center with a hardware store and
Yeah.
all that. And then South Milton was pretty much, there was nothing past, well, McDonald's, Sherwood Forest, that area,
Right.
the whole, that all the stuff on the east side wasn't there yet. So you'd sit in McDonald's and be looking across the street into the woods.
Yeah, wow.
So it was a much smaller town.
Yep. So you graduated in the winter of 75, 76?
And then I was a substitute teacher for a few months just to make some money. Just substituting in Los Alamos was kind of interesting. I was substitute. I was doing it almost always at the high school level. I did do one day at junior high, one of the junior highs, and said never again.
Oh,
Just
wow.
call me from high school. And I was substituting for, this was only 4 years, 4.5 years after I graduated. So I was substituting for the same teachers that I had had
Oh, my gosh.
when I was in high school. And that was one of the big things, is the kids were always, "So what was so and so like when you were in school here?" And it was a lot of fun. I actually enjoyed the substitute teaching, enjoyed the teaching part of it, but making $22 a day just really, that wasn't my road to self-sufficiency.
What were you thinking? I mean, did you think you wanted a career with the Park Service, or were you thinking, maybe
Oh
you were going
yeah,
to do something
yeah.
else?
At that point, I definitely wanted a career with the Park Service,
Okay.
and so I'd continued to apply for other parks, but wound up going back to Petrified Forest. And the just the resources, the physical environment of the park had kind of grown on me. The first summer I was there, I was kind of like, oh, this is really the middle of nowhere, and Holbrook really sucks. But the longer I stayed and started making friends in the area and getting out and hiking, I enjoyed it more and more.
Okay.
And then in 76, when I went back, I had the opportunity to, I was there in the springtime, so it wasn't so hot out there on the desert, and I started doing some more hikes and getting into the park's backcountry. And of course, at that time, Petrified Forest was small enough that there was no place in the park that wasn't accessible on a day hike.
Okay.
And so I was just exploring around and having a good time out there. And and then also in 76, I did have the opportunity to travel around a little bit more. I was, at that point, I wasn't worried about paying for college, but I was still trying to save my money to buy my own vehicle.
Okay.
So I didn't have a lot of disposable income, but I had some.
What were you driving with? What were you getting around with before you got your own vehicle?
My dad would loan me one of his cars.
Okay.
So I was driving this great big old Plymouth Fury station wagon. I'd take it on camping trips and just fold down the back seat and sleep in the back of the car.
That's handy.
It was very, very convenient. And I did get a little further afield when going up to like Canyon de Chelly and that sort of thing. And so let's see, 76. I started work in March, and in those days, seasonals worked 180-day appointment, which meant that you were allowed to work 180 days in the course of a calendar year. And so I started working, and I was doing, besides working the entrance station and interp, I was also doing the remittances to the Federal Reserve Bank. And so what they would do so that I wouldn't run out of time to make my appointment last longer is I would actually work most days of the week for the cooperating association. And then a day or two a week, I'd work for the Park Service so I could do the remittances.
Huh.
And when I was working for the cooperating association, I would work on the information desks in the visitor centers, but not in the entrance stations.
Was that a Petrified Forest National Park Association? What was their title?
The Petrified Forest Museum Association.
Okay.
And they had bookstores in the visitor centers at either end of the park, and they actually, it was kind of a funny thing. They had a board of directors that was mostly folks from Holbrook, and it was right about that time that KC Publications out in Las Vegas was getting going on their Story Behind the Scenery book series.
Okay.
And so they had been chunking along doing these Story Behind the Scenery books for a bunch of different parks, Grand Canyon. Well, they still have them. I mean, they're still out there. They had been writing the books for the different cooperating associations. And then at some point, I don't know when this happened, but at some point, the KC Publications, KC, didn't do them, went out to all these cooperating associations and said, hey guys, listen, this is a huge hassle for you guys. Why don't I just handle all the publication of all these books? I can print them up cheaper and all that kind of stuff, and then you'll just buy them from me. And so most of the cooperating associations did that, but the Petrified Forest Association said, no, we'll just keep the rights to our book. And so as a consequence, their profit margin on the than the Story Behind the Scenery book, which was by far the biggest seller, was much higher than most other parks were getting.
Interesting.
On those Story Behind the Scenery books. And so, in spite of the fact that Petrified Forest wasn't that big of a park, it was still the Museum Association was pulling in a fair amount of money. And
so they had money for staff. That way you could work in the park, sort of for the park, but weren't on the park accounts.
Most of the time. And at that time, the cooperating associations did have some funny flexibilities that they no longer have. I know that, it was a disaster when they decided that it wasn't appropriate, but at one time they were able to donate money to the park for park positions.
Wow.
So every year the Petrified Forest Museum Association would donate thousands of dollars to Petrified Forest National Park to hire Park Service employees, government employees. And and I don't remember what year it was, but eventually the Washington office or Congress or somebody said, no, this is inappropriate. We can't have a private organization funding government positions. And it decimated our seasonal staff. And so that was, there were times at Petrified Forest where you would walk into the visitor center and there just wouldn't be a ranger there. At that time we were all called park technicians, but it would all be PFMA staff handling the bookstore and the information desk and everything.
Huh. Okay.
So even though I had a 180-day appointment, I wound up working through 76 and 77 and into 1978. Yeah, 76, 77, and 78. From the spring of 76, cobbling together those the Park Service and the PFMA jobs, through the late spring of 1978.
Wow.
And
so you did like the place then?
I did, and I was picking up responsibilities as I went along.
Like
I,
what?
In 76, I was kind of, it was more of a seniority thing. I'd just been around a long time. Most people only worked 1 year at Petrified Forest.
Okay.
And so I knew the place better than other people did. And then in 76, we had the bicentennial. There was a lot going on. The Painted Desert Inn, we'd opened up more of it. In 77, I was actually in charge of the Painted Desert Inn. So we had a, that summer, we had, how did that all work? We had some material from Hubble Trading Post's collections. So we had a display of Native arts and crafts, and we also had artwork from various contemporary Native artists on display. And so in the spring of 77, the winter and spring, we kept the Painted Desert Inn, just the information booth, open, and I would work that, mostly being in the back room, making up labels for displays for the summer exhibition on a Leroy lettering set, a mechanical lettering set.
Yep.
And I got quite proficient at that.
Cool.
I could really whip the stuff out. And then that summer, I didn't hire employees, but I was in charge of the operations up there. And so when people were assigned to the inn, why then I would, tell them what to do. So I wasn't a supervisor, but I was kind of a director. And so, I want you to go out and work on the point on pitching a point and talk to people out there. I want you to load the museum.
So you'd sort of work on the scheduling. Okay. And yeah. Was Ames still superintendent?
Yes. Yes, he was. And, so 70, that was the winter of 76/77. And that was my first full winter in the park as well. And by that, by that point, I was living in one of the two little houses, the CCC shacks, across the street from the Painted Desert Inn. And in the wintertime, I was just up there all by myself.
Wow.
Which was, in the beginning, it was kind of weird, but eventually I really got to enjoy it. It was once, because of course Petrified Forest closed at night, and still does. And so once the gates closed, there was almost no traffic. Every now and then somebody would be driving back and forth from one end of the park to the other. But I was just up there all alone. And if I looked out one window, I could see the lights on I-40 going off to the east, but it was just completely dark out all the other windows.
Nice.
And it was, every now and then, people would walk into my house. I always had to keep the door locked. I know one time I got out of the shower and thought I heard something, so I stuck my head out. There was a family in my living room.
Okay.
Is this the curio shop?
Oops.
Does it look like a curio shop to you? another time, somebody knocked at my door, and I opened up the door, and they said, "Do you have a hammer?" And I said, "Yeah. What can I help you with?" And said, "Oh, we locked our keys in our car, and we need a hammer to break out the window."
Oh.
And I said, "Well, I have a hammer, but why don't we go and see if we can unlock the door?" And he said, "Oh, it's a rental. It doesn't matter. let's try and unlock the door." And so I got a coat hanger, and this was back when you could open up a car door with a coat hanger.
Yeah.
And I went over, and it took me about 30 seconds to unlock the door. And the guy's going, "What are you doing out here in the middle of nowhere? You could make a fortune if you lived in Chicago." Went their merry way.
That's so, why I'm living here, is because I don't want to live in Chicago.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Exactly. So then the summer of 77, of course, we had our full suite of seasonals, and Painted Desert Inn was going along, and that was Dave Ames was still superintendent. I was pretty much working the Painted Desert Inn since I was in charge of it. And then at night, the downstairs of the Painted Desert Inn had been cleaned out, but it really wasn't open to the public yet. And we would there was an old refrigerator down there, and so we would keep beer in the refrigerator. And then after the park closed, the seasonals would all get together, and we would have dances up there in the inn.
Oh, nice.
It was a lot of fun, and probably not the eventually the park. I don't remember what precipitated it, whether it was a new superintendent or what. But the park eventually said, "No, you can't keep throwing, drinking, and dancing, and all that kind of stuff." And
get the beer out of the refrigerator.
Yeah, and but the summer, what we would do is we'd all gotten into country dancing. And so we would, we'd have dances up there, and then we would also hit the bars in Holbrook and Winslow, watch people dancing, and then come back and figure out the dance steps.
So this was country swing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which was all the rage there in the late 1970s.
Right. It was. And we would, every now and then we'd make trips all the way up to Flagstaff.
Oh, wow.
And then we'd come back and learned or observed some really complicated steps, and then just blow everybody in Holbrook off the dance floor.
with the Flagstaff moves.
Right, exactly.
Wow.
And by 77, finally, in the spring of 77, I finally did buy a pickup truck and started really, really exploring around more, getting up into up onto the reservation, up into southern Utah, natural bridges, getting down in the White Mountains, Flagstaff area. I'd also periodically just do overnight trips to Phantom Ranch at Grand Canyon. I remember one where I think it was in January, but stormy weather. It was just a gorgeous hike. I went down the Kaibab Trail. I didn't see a soul from the time I left the trailhead until I got down to the Bright Angel Campground.
Wow.
Which was very, very cool until I got, down to about the red wall. And then it was kind of like, okay, this is like, really, where is everybody?
Hmm. Yeah. But it was January.
Yeah.
Off-peak travel, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. So it was a lot of fun. And so 77, and then also continued hiking and exploring around the park. And then in 78, make sure I'm not getting ahead of myself here. Yeah, in 78, I finally got a job at a different park, and I got a summer seasonal position up at Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park. And
Klondike Gold Rush?
Yeah, in Skagway, Alaska. And I had been that year, it was kind of a case of, yeah, I like Petrified Forest, but I need to go someplace else. And
boy, now that's a change going from
it was
Alaska, it's like cold and trees and water, and
it was funny. One of my my best supervisors ever with the Park Service at Petrified Forest, my first couple of years, had worked in Alaska during World War II, I think it was.
Oh, wow.
And he had these great stories, and I just, it was, oh, yeah, I'd really like to get up to Alaska. And so that winter, the winter of 78, when it was time to apply for seasonal positions, I went through and I called every park in Alaska and said, what do you got coming up that I should apply for? And talked to different folks. And at Klondike Gold Rush, they were working on creating some positions, but they hadn't been approved yet, so they weren't showing up in the seasonal catalog.
Hmm.
And I applied for those, doing my application vague enough that I would be eligible for them, and got one of them. And it was working on a trail crew on the Chilkoot Trail. So everybody, everybody was very happy for me at Petrified Forest and the going away party and all that. And the day before I left, we had like 6 inches of snow, which is a huge amount of snow for Petrified Forest, which
of course
everybody blamed on me for moving to Alaska. And so I put a bunch of my stuff in storage, headed up to Alaska.
And when was this exactly? What month do you remember roughly?
I went up. It was, I left Petrified Forest at the beginning of May, had a couple of weeks off, and then to get all my stuff stored and outfitted myself for Alaska, and then flew up to Alaska at the end of May. And,
okay.
It was my luggage was, for my suitcase, I had a foot locker, and then I had that green striped backpack that I mentioned before.
Yep.
I had that jam full of stuff. And then for a sleeping bag on that, I had a duffel bag.
Okay.
Full of stuff tied onto the pack frame, which I had to sign a release form for. But flew up to Alaska with all that junk. And
where did you fly to?
I flew from Albuquerque to Seattle, to Juneau.
Okay.
And then from Juneau, I took the state ferry up to Skagway.
Okay.
And they put us
Hey,
up.
Carl, you know what? We've been happily going on for about an hour and 5 minutes here. Maybe this is a great place to say, oh, let's stop right there. Then we can pick this up with your travel to Skagway and what it was like working for Klondike Gold Rush.
Okay, that sounds good.
All right. Is there anything else you want to add to this? If we put a line here, looking back, is there anything else you want to add to leaving Petrified 78, or should we just say this is good?
Well, I would say just to kind of sum things up or whatever.
Please.
I spent so long at Petrified Forest that it had kind of ingrained me into the park structure there. A couple of things that I had gotten involved with while I was there, the whole Bandelier Wilderness thing, and then having a geologist for next door neighbor had kind of excited my interest in geology, which is something that continued to grow later on in my career.
Okay.
And the fact that Petrified Forest at the time, its reputation was improving a little bit.
Okay.
All the work that we had done on the bicentennial and that kind of stuff, it wasn't quite didn't quite have the bad reputation that it did before. It still didn't have a great reputation, but it was improving.
Okay.
So, and
you mentioned someone who kind of mentored you working for the Park Service area. You can give me his name.
Probably my best mentor at Petrified was my supervisor, whose name was George Falkenberg.
How do you spell that?
George is just a common spelling, of course, but Falkenberg is Falkenburg.
Thank you.
And he had worked, he'd been in the Air Force and I think in the Army Air Corps, I'm not sure, but during World War II, his wife had, Neva, N-E-V-A, had actually been a Harvey girl at the Alta Var.
Oh, wow.
And they were... they were great. They were, he was a really good supervisor because he wasn't all caught up so much in what was, how you were supposed to do things. He was more interested in how to make the right things happen. And so he was, he knew how to work for the government. It was the sort of thing where he could be your friend and your supervisor at the same time.
Nice.
And he was pretty laid back. You know, even when he was angry, I remember my first summer. I don't remember what I had screwed up, but he had corrected me. Later on in the entrance station, I said something about, well, I thought George would be really mad about that. And the person I was working with said he was really mad. That's what he's like when he's really mad.
Wow.
Huh. Oh, okay. So, and here I felt corrected but not driven down. But then they were also the ones that would have all the seasonals over to their house for Thanksgiving dinner when the shifts ended. And that kind of stuff. So, he was one of the best supervisors I ever had with the Park Service.
Did he kind of inspire you? It's like, I want to be a supervisor like George.
Not so much a supervisor like George, but especially just the overall attitude.
Okay.
That, you know, I like to be able to get things done, and you know, okay, this is the system that I'm working in. And this might be dumb, but if you want to get something done, this is how you can work through the system to make it happen.
Okay.
And I don't know that I was ever, well, I know I was never as proficient at it as he was, but at the same time, I think it helped my attitude.
Yeah,
so yeah, he retired somewhere in that stretch, retired to Meadview, and in fact, I actually helped him move household stuff out to Meadview.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Wow, Meadview in 1970, 78, 79, there wasn't much going on out there.
No, it was really the middle of nowhere, and it was kind of funny because we got out there, and I realized that those were the Grand Wash Cliffs. And so I was helping him move. I drove out to, I guess it's called Airport Point at the time. I think they call it Wallapai Point now. But anyway, out there at the end of the runway where you can look down on Pierce Basin and
see
the Grand Wash Cliffs and all that. And it was like, oh, wow, this is really cool out here.
Neat. And had the road down to Pierce Ferry was there, but I'm not sure if the road down to South Cove had been made yet.
It had,
okay.
I can't remember if it was paved. I think it was, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
But yeah, and the lake was full. I mean, you know, you'd look down at Pierce Basin, and there was water all the way across it and going up into the canyon.
Wow. Wow.
Not like today.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Interesting.
So, but yeah, that was... By the time I left Petrified Forest, I was really excited to be going someplace else and seeing how someplace else operated and all that kind of stuff. And I was very glad to be getting out of Petrified Forest, but it was also a case of I didn't hate the place, and that's why I was leaving or anything like that.
Nice,
Felt ready to move on.
Excellent.
But as we'll see, I wound up coming back. Several
more times. don't spoil it now.
okay.
Great. All right. Well, with that, we will wrap up part two of oral history interview with Carl Bowman. Today is Friday, November 6th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Carl, thank you so very much for this.
Absolutely.